Good afternoon. So last time we talked about this idea that's pretty common in distributed systems of transparency, that we wanted to provide the idea that there isn't really a distributed system there, everything's just kind of local, and it just works just like it were local. And we saw two cases where we're trying to provide the solution. One was remote procedure calls, which we want to look like local procedure calls. Another was network file systems, which we want to look like local file systems. And for remote procedure calls, we learned that, well, we didn't quite achieve that. And if you looked at like my example of the Google RPC system, like in some cases, they probably didn't seem to really care about being fully transparent. So they had these basic idea where they had these interface description languages rather than writing normal code. And we've made this work to be generic among architectures or languages. And sort of our big threat to transparency in this case was that, you know, here we had errors were a bit different. In addition to the stuff we did to be generic between different machines meant that, well, you kind of had to know you're working with different machines. Then we talked about network file systems, where remote procedure calls were a convenient way of implementing them, but we had this problem of state, that we didn't want the server to keep track of all the clients, so one issue is just a practical one of, like, that's a lot to keep track of. But there was a more troubling issue, which is, what if the clients crash? Well, then the server needs to still keep track of stuff or somehow know if the clients crash. That's very complicated. What if the server crashes? Then all the clients stop working. You know, that's not something you want to happen. Even if we reboot the server, it seems like we've lost data and the clients don't know where they are. So we have this idea of a stateless server where the server doesn't actually remember anything about the clients, it just knows about the file system in the case of our network file system. And the clients track all the information they care about. So they track these opaque IDs and cookies and things like that for, in the case of our network file server. So they know all the files they have open. They just tell the server, hey, this file, I'm reading it, tell me about it. The server doesn't know what files it has open. It doesn't care. It doesn't need to do something because the client has the file open. So that's where we left off. So questions about any of that? Okay. So we have this working network file system. But one issue, and an issue we talked about with RPCs, is going to be performance. So with RPCs, we mentioned that local procedure calls like nanoseconds, remote procedure calls like microseconds or milliseconds. Story is a little less bad when we're comparing system calls and remote procedure calls, but it's still not great. And if we think about what NFS version 2, that stateless server solution we have, does, well, it has some performance issues. Each read goes to the server. We'd like not to do that. That's very slow. We built our whole system to, you know, do all this caching, and now we're saying, well, sorry, you need to go to the server. We're not using that cache anymore. And each write goes to the server. We built this whole system so we could like have these dirty things in our page cache and write them out later. Well, sorry, we're gonna go to the server. Another thing we don't handle is, you know, if the server goes away, like we can recover when the server comes back, but if we're disconnected from the server, your machine that uses this network file system just doesn't work for that time. And that's inconvenient. So these are all things we're going to talk about, ways of kind of fixing. So this performance issue is going to be a bit tricky because, well, we need to update. You know, we want to have that cache work, but there's going to be some issues about keeping that cache consistent. So the reason we're going to the server is, well, when we read the file, we don't know when it's changed. And the server is not tracking that we have it open. And that's a deliberate design choice. That it's not tracking that we have it open. So it certainly can't tell us. So let's talk about like what's going to happen if we do caching. So here I have a client, and I'm going to say, I'm going to cache things. So I have a cache copy of notes.txt. And then some other client decides to write to notes.txt. So how can client A discover that? So what should client A do if it wants to cache things with our current design? Yeah?
Does it have to like check with the server if it's been changed?
Yeah, so the solution we have right now that works, that saves reading, that still lets us cache things, is that we can just ask, did it change? Did it change? Did it change? And in fact, if you, on our slide of calls for NFS version 2, there's one called lookup, which returned like modify time information, which would let us do that. So this, saves us reading the data again, but it doesn't actually help us very much because most of our cost in contacting the server is not transferring the data of some small file called notes.txt. It's the time spent sending the message and waiting for the reply. And boy, are we still paying for that here. And the other issue we have is, what if I update my cache copy in client A? Then, I need to figure out when I tell the server about the update. And if we have any option other than right away, then client B is going to read from the server. The server knows nothing about what files client A has open. So it's going to say, OK, here it is, and it's not going to reflect the update. So our fix for this, of course, is that the answer to this, when does A tell the server about the update, would be right away. But that means our write call now doesn't get the advantage of having this nice cache. Because even though maybe we don't have, we have to send the write right away, we're losing a lot of our benefit of caching. So this is what NFS version 2 basically did. But the performance here is not great. So later in NFS, they wanted to allow actual caching. So they have a solution in their version 3 to allow caching. That's better than this. We don't want to allow caching where we have to always check with the server before we use the cache version, and we always write our updates to the server, because that's just so slow. We want to do more caching. We want to actually get an advantage from caching where we don't have to do this, and we still use caching. Now, and we did this, remember, because we wanted to allow the server not to remember anything about the clients, but it's too slow. So NFS version 3 has a solution where we don't sacrifice this attribute of allowing the server to remember clients. So we're going to keep that, and we're still going to do caching. And we have this great solution that a lot of you are not going to like. And that solution is, we're going to allow inconsistency. We're just going to say, sometimes you're not going to read the latest version. Sometimes the latest version won't be written to the server. And we're OK with that. Now, you might say, this seems like a horrible solution. We're going to constrain this a little bit. We're not going to allow all types of inconsistency. We're going to allow very specific kinds of inconsistency that we're OK with. We're going to have a different model for when you can expect things to be updated than the one we have with a local file system. So we're going to lose some transparency. Now you're going to notice this doesn't behave like a normal file system anymore. But we're going to still make it work normally for most use cases. Usually you're not going to care. And this is going to be based on an observation about how programs usually work. So if we think of our typical word processor, for example, if I'm editing a file, I open the file, I load it into memory, and close it. And then later on, I do the save operation, where I open the file, write it from memory, and close it. This is typically how user-facing programs edit files. That you have this save operation, you don't write the file till then. When you load the file, you make a copy somewhere, Maybe you have some temp files you're working with or something. Typically, you don't work from the original. The most common pattern, I'm not saying all programs do this, all editing programs, but this is a very common pattern. So with this in mind, you know, what do you, or even ignoring this, what do you expect? Let's say I have a shared file system, and I have a word processor document. And let's say I open the file while someone else is saving it. What do I expect to happen?
An error.
An error? Okay. Any other ideas? Yeah. So you might see the version before. Any other ideas? Okay. Another possibility you might imagine is maybe you see some of their changes, not all of them, because it's in the middle of saving. So how about if you save a file while someone else is saving it? What do you expect? Yeah. So there will be some sort of conflict, yeah? Okay, so you start overwriting each other, you get something weird, yeah?
Yeah, I was gonna say like the last person to save like overwrites the person that finished.
Okay, you're saying only one of the persons would actually end up saving? Yeah, so we have all these possibilities and they're all reasonable. And the key thing I'd like you to observe is that broadly, we don't expect these scenarios to work. You know, we don't think that this is going to have good things happen. And users, you know, aren't actually going to find that, for the most part, weird. That if two people are editing and saving the document at the same time, that I get weird results. That's not actually an exceptional attribute. And we're going to take advantage of this in choosing our inconsistency. So we're going to be inconsistent. But we're going to be consistent in these types of cases where users aren't going to be surprised, because they're going to say, oh, okay, yeah, well, I was saving at the same time as someone else. Of course something weird happened. And this is based on the fact that most applications don't expect you to have these sorts of concurrent accesses and don't expect to make them work, and users aren't really anticipating that this is a scenario that has a well-defined result. Even though in our local file system, there's a rule, like the first write happens, then the next write happens, whatever orders the write happens in, that's what ends up happening. You know, there's rules like that, but we don't really have an intuitive outcome for this. So we're going to have a model for cache to help us with caching, where we're gonna say scenarios like this are gonna do something different than the local file system, something that we call inconsistent, with, you know, as far as like, are going to read things that aren't written, that, you know, aren't what was mostly smoothly written. But we're breaking this sort of scenario, no one's going to care. At least hopefully. And so the compromise is known as open to close consistency. And so what we do here is, on opening a file, then we ask the server, hey, what's the latest version of the file? And we make sure that's the version we have cached. We update our cache at that point. Whenever you open a file, we say, better have the latest version. This corresponds to our opening operation, or if we're saving, if we want to look at what's there before, to our saving operation. And when we close a file, we're going to make sure anything we've written only to our cache gets updated at the server before that close finishes. So while we're saving, we might not be sending things to the server right away, but when we finish saving and have that close call happens, it's going to go to the server. So as long as we don't save at the same time, we still get consistent results. Yeah?
I'm just wondering, just closing a file in this case, is like from a user perspective, is that like when you choose to save, or is that when you're done like leaving the file?
So the question is, what does this mean from a user perspective? So these are defined based on, So this is based on, this is the open, you know, syscall basically, and this is the close syscall. So this is opening and closing from the operating system's perspective. So with our typical model of how we said a word processor works, this means opening the file, opens, copies it to memory, closes, and saving a file, opens, writes, closes. So with our typical model, the open and save operations would correspond to this, but of course it's not guaranteed that all programs work that way, and if they don't, we're in trouble. But this is the open syscall and the closed syscall are going to be implemented to do this. So this way, at the least, you know, as long as you know each of our loads and saves are one at a time, everything's fine. And while we have the file open, while we're loading it, or if we have it, if the application keeps it open for a long time and is actively changing it during that, then we can keep it cached. And we don't have to keep asking the server, hey, is this still the latest version? Is this still the latest version? Because we're assuming that no one's going to bother accessing it while we're accessing it. Okay, so questions in the scheme? Okay, so this is a viable approach. It's used, and note that this is just a choice that's not always going to make things, you know, consistent to the user because we're kind of making a guess about how programs are written. But it's a, you know, it lets us do a lot of caching that we wouldn't otherwise be able to do. Most notably, we're caching while programs are loading and saving files, which is going to be most of our benefit, hopefully. And because we only check for the latest version, if we load a file we've loaded earlier, we could still have it cached from earlier. We just send one message to the server to check that it's cached, and then we just assume that the version we have cached is right, even though someone else might edit it immediately after that. We don't care. So something to note about this is that this doesn't actually bound your inconsistency. So let's say I open a file, sleep for a day, you know, then read it later. I still have the file descriptor open. I read it. In this model, we might get a day-old version of the file. And if you don't like that, and some NFS implementations don't like that, there's an easy modification that you can say after some amount of time, like a minute, I'm going to check again with the server regardless, even if it wasn't opened again. That's an easy way of making the really bad inconsistencies not happen. Yeah. So this is a question for you. Question is, what's the issue? Do I care about seeing a day-old version? It depends on what your idea is and about how things should work.
Like, why would you care? Or like, what's an example when you would care?
So this would be the notion of if I'm sitting in front of a word processor and its idea of load the file is use the already open file descriptor to reload it. So the model where this would cause confusion for a user is, let's say my word processor's reload from file operation doesn't actually reopen the file, it just takes the file it has open and rereads it. In that case, I'd be really confused by this if someone else modified the file in that day.
Oh, if someone else modified it.
Yeah.
So when you say you sleep for a day, that just means that?
One program is sleeping for a day, the other program, the file might be modified elsewhere. So this is avoiding making it so those really weird situations where there's, you know, a lot of time where we say it was written an hour ago, why don't you see it? We can avoid that pretty easily, and this still is a low cost because we can set this threshold to like minutes and still allow caching on the small time scales without any messages being sent back and forth to the server. So questions on this open to close consistency model. Okay, so another way we might deal with this sort of caching issues is by saying, well, a stateless server was a mistake. We should really add some state so we don't have to keep checking over and over again, hey, was it really changed? The server should keep track of a little bit of information to know whether whether someone has the file open and is reading it. And the observation we can make about this is that this is less bad than the other state we were talking about, because if the server gets it wrong, the consequences aren't as bad. Like, we aren't going to like keep information around forever. We can, you know, if we can't contact the client, you know, we can say it's responsible for reloading its cache or whatever. So the Andrew file system is an example of something which uses a stateful server primarily for this reason. The server keeps track of clients which have notified it that they want to be informed when a file gets changed. They can structure this so that they don't keep like the sort of state we talked about on naive solution keeping. It's just a little bit of information about what clients want to be notified when a file changes, and that those that information can be bounded. So we can say, notify me in the next hour if it changes, and have the client renew it to avoid keeping information forever when clients crash. Now, despite using this nice mechanism, they have still chosen to make a consistency compromise. They said, even though we could notify clients every time a write happens because we're doing the stateful server thing, you know, we're keeping track of it, you know, we don't have to have them check, we're not gonna allow, we're just gonna choose a consistency compromise to make things a little faster, even though we are bothering to keep state on our server. And the big way they do this is that NFS, we say we open and close, you know, those are important operations, but our reads and writes are actually like little chunks of the file. They're whatever, you know, like a block size or something like that. In AFS, they've said, well, the way we're going to read and write files is that the client machines are going to read and write the entire file and cache it. We're going to build around caching. We're not going to say caching is a thing you do sometimes when you can, like NFS is saying. We're going to say we're building around caching. You want to read a file, you cache it locally until you're done with it. And when you're done with it and you want to write it out, you write out the whole thing that you have cached. And this has some pros and cons. So what are some good and bad things about this idea? Yeah.
Since you're reading and writing the entire file at one time, you would get that case where like some writes from one user are there and others aren't or something.
Yeah, so even though we are allowing inconsistency, this read and write the entire file model limits the sort of confusing things which can happen. And makes it probably a more easy to understand set of things for users. So anything else? Yeah.
Isn't it slower to write an entire file if you only change like a few characters?
Yeah, so if our assumption is we only change a few characters, you want the NFS way. NFS lets us only change those few characters. With AFS, we have to change the whole thing. So there's kind of an assumption built into AFS that usually when we edit files, we edit the whole file. Which, well, it's sometimes true and sometimes not. Okay. So the way AFS works, therefore, is known as last writer wins. So I mentioned this inconsistency thing. So if we have two things writing to a file at the same time with AFS, client A writes to it, closes it, writes the whole file. Client B writes to its cache copy, closes it, writes the whole file. And, well, this is the last write which happened. Client B's version of the file is going to be there, and nothing from client A. Whereas NFS allows a more confusing situation where, because we're writing in piecemeal, we can end up having it be the case that, in this case, block one of the file happens to be written from A, and block 0 and 2 come from B, because we wrote in these smaller segments. And note that open to close consistency didn't help us here because we opened, it wasn't modified. We opened, it still wasn't modified. Okay, so questions about this? Okay, so I told you that despite having this, AFS does do this notion of keeping track of who has the file open and telling them about modifications. It just only tells them about the modification, which is writing the whole file back, typically on a close. But if you have the file open for a long time and someone else writes back to the server, either by closing it or by emptying their cache and writing it for that reason, you'll find out about it. So to do this, we're going to have extra information track. So when a client opens the file, it's going to fetch the file, the whole thing, as we learned, and it's going to register a callback with the server. That the server's going to keep track of. So this is our state that we were previously trying to avoid. Now the server keeps track of this little bit of state about its clients. And client B, it can write it, register a callback. And this means that if client B finishes writing notes.txt, the server is going to look up that list of callbacks and tell client A, hey, your cache copy of notes.txt is wrong. So in this way, we can update the caches proactively. We don't need to recheck on open, because we know if someone else opens the file and edits it and writes it in the meanwhile, the server will tell us about it, provided they finish that whole write. But this still allows some inconsistency because, well, we can, you know, we can open the file from one place and another, and, well, when we open the file before it's written, we're seeing the old version. But at least we're seeing a consistent version, which maybe makes more sense. So that's the AFS model. So you might say, well, we're keeping the state here. How does this work with failures? So this is handier with this is like less concerning with failures than like keeping track of file descriptors. And the big reason is that if the server crashes and comes back up, it's easy for the clients to re-register all these callbacks with the server. They just go through their cache and say, what files do I have cached? Let me tell you about all of them. So there's a mechanism for recovering from server crashes here, even though this is a stateful protocol, because the server isn't tracking any information the clients don't also have. And similarly, if a client goes away, the server can just say, I can't contact you, I'm forgetting about your callback, and the worst that can happen is the client sees the wrong version of the file, and the client hopefully corrects this by trying to make sure it knows, it tells the server it's still around every once in a while. Yeah?
So are those callbacks
So the question is, are those callbacks always there? The callbacks should be there the entire time a client has the file cached.
So I thought that, so then how is it stateless if the server...
This is not stateless.
Oh, it is not stateless.
This is stateful.
Oh, okay.
So this is explicitly, we are adding state. And, you know, so we've added state, we've made our server more complicated. I mentioned, like, we have strategies of dealing with failure, but they're a lot more work than they were with NFS. But our benefit is that now we don't have to ask the server, is this thing updated, when the answer is no almost all the time. And we don't even send any extra messages because we just start saying, I want to read this file, and by the way, tell me if it changes. So we don't even send any extra messages to do this. So as a result of AFS's write the whole file model, even though they have this idea of callbacks, they still have the same closed open consistency, that when you open a file, you're effectively checking for a new version. We don't actually contact the server to do that, But we know if someone else closed the file, you learn about it by the time you do the open and fetch the new file, or get it from your cache without contacting the server. And when you close a file, you update the server and therefore notify anyone else who might open it about the modifications. So it achieves the same consistency model, but hopefully with less redundant saying, asking the server, is it updated, is it updated, when we open files lots of times. Okay, so questions about NFS or AFS? Okay, so one. So one other thing I mentioned is that so far we're assuming that you can always contact the server. But another model we might want to support is offline operation. So this is a common thing that network file systems want to do. And we can use something like the AFS model where we write whole files for this. But we just need some way of dealing with the conflict. Like in a case like this, where we have disconnected operation, we're going to do these write operations, but at very different times. That we're going to close the file and we're going to delay writing. We're going to close the file and then we're going to write when we have a connection. And that might delay it very much, and will trigger this sort of last writer win scenario if we do the naive thing of just saying, well, we're not connected to the server, I'm just going to assume my cache copy is right. So our simplest offline operation technique is, assume the cache copy is right, and we can use something like AFS for that, which I said was built around caching. But the problem is that we have these conflicts here where we lose data. So there is a system built around this, which is similar to the strategies you might use, called CODA. And what CODA does is we cache things, and we know we're not going to get a callback when we're disconnected, so we just use our cached version. And we remember the idea of the file, so we can compare these version numbers to figure out if we have a conflicting version, and then do something. What that something is, well, that's the main reason why systems like this haven't caught on. What do we do? Do we tell the user, hey, sorry, you have different people modify this file? But, we can do something about it. We don't just lose data. And the idea there was that in this model, we wouldn't just cache things that you read. You would specify, hey, I want all my home directory available when I'm disconnected. And we'd cache the whole thing all the time. And when online, we'd write back anything which changed well after it was closed to the server and detect those conflicts to figure out what to do. And, well, this is something that you might do in other systems so Dropbox, it's basically the same idea and probably the same kind of ugliness around conflicts. Of who knows what happens. Okay, but we could add this to our normal file system. Okay, so questions about that very brief sketch on disconnected operation? So we're just reusing our caching infrastructure to say, we'll just use the cache and assume it's right when we don't have a connection to the server. Okay, so let's talk about
Wouldn't you always want to just update based on the local changes? If the ID number is newer for the locally updated file, wouldn't you just want to check that at the online?
The question is, wouldn't we always want to use the highest ID? So it turns out that we can't really store numerical IDs. And the issue is that we may have made changes and someone else may have made changes starting from the same version. And this is what, if you use version control, as a merge conflict. So we need to deal with that type of scenario. And that's why, like, we can't just use IDs, or like timestamps would be another example. Like, we could have the most recent version happen, but that would be very confusing if you your edits just disappeared because you shared a file with someone else. Okay, so our next topic is going to be about failure. And to talk about failure in distributed systems, we need to talk about how connections fail. And this means that we're going to need to go a little bit into how connections are implemented. So let's talk about network failures. So let's say I want to append to a file. So I send a message from machine A to machine B, where the file is, telling it to append to my file. And two things could happen. Either my message gets there, and it's intact, and machine B appends to the file, or it doesn't. And with what I've just shown you here, I can't tell, as from machine A, do I need to resend that message or not? The network might have had a problem, or it might not have. I have no way of knowing. So we want to deal with this scenario. This is a very common way networks fail, like our Wi-Fi just not connected right now. We send a message, goes nowhere. Wouldn't handle that. So the simple solution is we send back a acknowledgement message. Yep, I appended it, we're all set. Now, there's a problem here, which is, well, the same thing can happen to our acknowledgement message. That maybe the network was working when we send the append message, then it stopped working in the other direction. And if I just want to retry, I don't want to say append again, then my file now has two copies of the thing I'm appending. That's not something I want. So our solution for this is that we need to retry in an idempotent way. Like our redo logs, we need some way of saying, do this again, but don't do it, overwrite it, make it do double. So append if you haven't already, like append at some particular place, we need to send something that, if it's done twice, it's not a big deal. Okay, so that's what we do. But another issue is, when do we give up? When do we assume that things don't work? But this is basically the best we can do, with the issue that when things don't work, we're kind of going to be stuck thinking, maybe it worked and I didn't get an acknowledgement. Or maybe the network's never worked. Because we could just keep having the first scenario happen over and over and over again. Or we could keep having this scenario happening over and over again. It could just be we asked to append and it didn't get to the other machine. And we have no way of knowing. But this is the best we can do, basically. And we're going to try to, given this constraint of how networks work, build something that's reliable. We'll talk about what I mean by that more precisely. But our basic idea is that, our connections, we're implementing them with these acknowledgments and retrying, and we have to give up. And when we give up, we have to give up eventually or wait forever. And when that happens, we don't know what the actual outcome is. We don't know, did it get the message and never have a chance to reply to us, or did it never get the message? And when we're talking about connections like in POSIX, an important thing to note is that the connection, with your sockets, it gives you errors on when writes and reads fail. It's tracking whether the remote program received data. It doesn't know if the remote program actually got to do anything with it. Maybe the machine crashed after it read the message. And we're going to want to be reliable even if that happens. So we don't want acknowledgments that you received the message. We want acknowledgments that you did the thing the message told you to do. Okay. So talk about this. We're going to need to talk about how machines fail. And for this course, we're going to keep this simple. So how machines fail is complicated. We're going to have this fail-stop model. I'm going to assume that when a machine fails, the way it's going to fail is it's just going to stop responding. Or alternately, it fails in some other way, but we can detect that and pretend it's not responding. And you might say, okay, that seems like basically the worst, but it's not. There's another model of failure known as Byzantine failures, where we say the failing machine does the worst possible thing. The failing machine tells us, yep, I appended, and it did nothing. You know, something like that. We're not going to assume that model. That model is really hard to deal with. We're going to start with this fail-stop model, this nice, simple model where when things fail, at least it's pretty clear that they're, you know, the machine just acts as if it's not there. And when we deal with a failure, we're going to have these two broad techniques that we're going to use. So one technique is we want to, a machine's going to fail, we want to make sure that when the machine comes back up, we recover. That the machine's going to somehow be recovered, you know, and restored to working condition. And when that happens, we want to make sure everyone knows what's supposed to be happening and everyone agrees on all the changes which we're supposed to make. That, you know, we don't have some disagreement on whether something was appended to file A. We know exactly what happened. Another model that we'll talk about briefly is we could rely on a quorum of machines working. So we could say we're going to have multiple machines that all do the same thing. And as long as some of them work, we're OK. You know, as long as half the machine, a little more than half the machines work, we're okay. As long as 2 out of 3 work, everything's fine, and we'll do everything on all 3 of the machines. So if any 2 of them work, we'll get the right answer. So this is something we can do to handle failures. It requires extra machines, and the idea is that if, even if the failed machines can't be recovered, you can replace them because you have these backup copies. We're going to first talk about dealing with this. How do I just recover when the machine comes back up? The simplest scenario, which is surprisingly tricky. Just this simple scenario. And what we're going to want to do is we're going to do what's called a distributed transaction. That two machines are going to agree to do something or not do something. Even if a machine fails in the middle of it, we're going to either do it or not do it. We're not going to have one machine do it, one machine get confused and not do it. They're either both going to do it or both going to not do it. We're always going to have a consistent state. You might say, why would you want to do this? So one common proposed idea is we have some data distributed across multiple machines. So let's say I have 2 machines storing records about students and 1 machine storing records about courses. And I want to update what students are in what courses. And that's going to require updating some data on machine A and some data on machine C. And I want to make sure that even if machine A, B, and C go, you know, have a failure, lose power, or something like that, that we agree what students are in what courses, even though that information is distributed across the 2 machines. That it's not the case that machine C thinks a student's in a course and machine A doesn't, or vice versa. So there's a simple solution to this, which is a centralized solution. So in that solution, I'm going to have a machine D, and the machine D is going to decide what to do. And machine D is going to keep a redo log for everything. And we're just going to pretend machine A and C are just these data storage machines. That really, machine D is the one you contact. It just uses those machines as like hard drives. So this is a working model. And we're using redo logging. So if machine D fails, we have our redo log. And if it's committed in the log, we're going to make the change when machine D comes back. If not, we're not. Everything's nice and consistent. But this is a little not great. We really want the machines to act independently. Because, well, presumably, when we look at, you know, our system, why did we have the student records on 2 machines? Probably because we felt it was too much for 1 machine. And this model, we're saying, nope, it's all going to be handled on 1 machine. You know, so that kind of seems to defeat the point of distributing it. So we're going to want a more decentralized solution, one which doesn't have this one central coordinator that handles all the modifications to the records and has one redo log. We're going to have that spread out across the machines. So we take advantage of the fact that we have multiple machines to handle student records. So accessing student records is hopefully faster. You have less contention with other students. So we want each machine responsible for their own data, and we're going to only coordinate it between the machines that this transaction, this thing we want to do or not do, crosses. So if we're modifying some student on machine A and the courses they're in, we only want to talk to machines A and C. Machine B, which holds other students' records, shouldn't be involved at all. And hopefully this means that if we want to split our student records across like 100 machines, that this is going to scale well, that we're not going to have problems of having too many students, as long as we also split the course records appropriately. That we're dividing up the work evenly. We don't have any one machine which is doing too much work. But our solution is going to look kind of similar to what my first proposal was of one machine with the redo log, but we're going to have all the machines with a log. So each machine is going to have a persistent log, which is going to work kind of like a redo log, but it's not going to just be one log, so it's going to have to be slightly different because we have to figure out what happens if one machine has one thing in its log and one doesn't. The other has something else. But this is how the machine's going to handle, what if I crash? If I crash, I'm going to read my log and figure out what was I doing. So that's how we deal with recovery. It's the same idea as the redo log. We're going to write to this log before we do an action to remember what do I intend to do. And if I come back up, I'm going to redo that action even though I might have already done it. But unlike our file system case, the action is not going to be writing something to disk. The action is going to be telling other machines something. So the way we're going to do these distributed transactions is this is going to be a thing called two-phase commit. So as you might guess, there's two phases. And one of the phases, we're going to vote on whether we do the transaction. So every machine's going to say, I'm going to do this operation for you. Or, no, we can't do that. Don't do it. Don't do it. Stop. And our rule is that every machine has to agree, vote to commit for us to commit. If they don't, we're aborting. So we have two phases. So our first phase is our voting phase, which is called preparing. We're going to have every machine say, I agree to commit this transaction, or I agree to abort this transaction. They're giving their vote on what should happen. Then we have our second phase, which is called finishing, where we collect the votes and figure out, did everyone agree to commit? And if so, we actually commit. And if not, we abort. Let's talk about preparing first. So when preparing, we're going to send a message to the other machines involved in this operation. And that message is a promise that we have to keep. And in order to make sure we keep that promise, we're going to record that promise in our log. So we are going to remember that promise even if we crash while we're sending the message saying, I agree to do this. And that's how we're going to make sure we keep this promise. And the promise is for agree to commit. It's not that the transaction is going to actually happen, but it's that I will accept this transaction. That if everyone agrees to do it, I'm going to do it too. Or we can promise to abort. And when we send that, we're saying, I will not accept this transaction. I'm not going to let this happen, no matter what everyone else says. So we make this promise, and we keep this promise by recording in our log. Another thing we have to do to keep the promise is we have to make sure we don't agree to also do interfering operations. So for example, if I agree to add a student to a class, I can't also agree at the same time to add another student to a class to take it over capacity. I need to say, sorry, I can't say I'm definitely going to accept this right now. So I need to either agree to abort or say, hey, I'm going to have to wait to respond to this in that sort of case. So we have to maintain our constraints, assuming this might happen, even though we're not sure yet. We don't know that we'll do it. We aren't going to do it right away. But we have to make sure everything's set up so it will work if everyone agrees to do it. Yeah.
What if the machine crashes and just never comes back? Doesn't agree to anything. Does that count as?
So the question is, what if the machine crashes and never comes back? So one thing we didn't say we do. We say we either agree to do something or not do something. We don't say we do this in any particular amount of time. So a compromise we're making here is we're saying, if a machine goes down, yeah, your system's down. But at least you have a consistent answer. And we'll get to that a little later. It's a good concern to have. So other questions? So we'll talk about other mechanisms for consistency. So this is not a distributed what is known as consensus mechanism, because it's unanimous, right? Like, we're doing things with, it's related to anything which keeps a distributed log, it's similar to this. Okay, so we have our voting step. Then we have our finishing step. So in our second phase, after everyone votes, you collect everyone's vote and figure out, did everyone agree to commit? And if so, you commit. That is, you actually do the operation, like you add the student to the class, you don't just reserve their seat. And you record that you did that in your log, so after you learn to do it, you will redo it if you crash. And you come back up. You make sure it's still done. And if you learn anyone aborts, you record that in your log, so you remember that forever, and you make sure you don't apply the transaction, and you can undo anything you reserved to make sure it would work, like reserving a seat in the class just in case. Okay, and if you're unsure, if you don't have the information, you just ask everyone again, hey, what did you agree to do? And you just keep asking until you get an answer, and you know that they don't change their mind. They make a promise that they're gonna keep, they're recording it, so you don't have to worry about getting inconsistent answers. And that's why we're relying on them only failing in the way of just stopping responding. So you pointed out that, wait, this seems like something which can wait for a long time. And it's actually problematic primarily for the reason that, well, we can't allow conflicting actions. That if I start adding a student to a class, then one of the servers goes down. Now there's a seat reserved in that class until we figure out what happened. And this is by design. We've said we're not going to allow to have inconsistent state. And in order to do that, we're saying it's too bad if a server goes down. We might wait for a very, very long time. Maybe we wait forever. And in that case, we're going to say we're going to have some system administrator get involved and fix what's going on and decide what to do about those students who tried to add themselves to a class or whatever. Okay. So that's just the high-level view of two-phase commit. So any questions about that? And the big caveat that we don't guarantee good response times. We just guarantee consistent results. So if we talk about a typical two-phase commit implementation, so we're going to actually implement this. And the high-level view I've given you is a little bit too complicated. So we're going to make this more concrete. And to do that, we're going to add this new type of machine called a coordinator. So this coordinator is going to take care of doing this administrative work of asking everyone to vote on the operation and collecting those votes and telling everyone about the results. And this is going to help us avoid having everyone talk to everyone to get all the votes. Now they just talk to the coordinator, and the coordinator tells everyone, so we're sending less messages around to everyone. So our protocol is going to be, the coordinator is going to tell each worker, each person in machine, other machine involved in the transaction, hey, prepare, please, this is the operation I want to do, figure out whether you're going to vote to do it or not. Then each worker figures that out and writes down in its log whether it's going to do it. Then it tells the coordinator, hey, yep, I'm going to vote to do it, or no, I'm going to vote never to do it. Then the coordinator, once it collects all the votes, it's going to send a message to the workers, every worker saying, hey, everyone voted to commit, Or, hey, someone voted to abort. Okay. This is our basic protocol. And when we're formalizing this, one thing we'll do is we'll try to like make it clear what happens in all cases. And something we want to do when we're worrying about a protocol like this where you're really concerned about correctness. We don't want to ever get into a case where we don't agree on what happens. We're going to want to try to prove what happens with this protocol. And to do this, we're going to have some formal way of specifying how the protocol works. And a typical way to do that is a state machine. So we're going to say each machine is in a particular state. And we're going to say, in this state, what does every single message do? And in this way, we can make sure we don't miss any cases. You know, we're going to know what every message does, and we're going to be able to figure out, can we ever get to something bad happening by just enumerating all the possible messages we could get at all possible times to figure out if something bad happens. Which we could maybe do with, if we had a programmatic representation of this, we could do that by machine. So here's our state machine for the coordinator. We have four states: initializing, waiting, aborted, and committing. Okay, so when we start initialize, we send prepare to everyone, and then we receive messages, and as we receive messages, once we receive agree to commit from everyone, we send commit and go to committed. If we receive any abort, we send, you know, any agreement to abort, we send abort. And a detail here is that as we're accumulating votes, we need to handle what if a server didn't get our prepare message. So a thing we're going to do here is we're going to resend after a timeout the prepare messages. And the prepare messages need to be structured in a way such that that's not going to be a problem. Like they need to have a unique ID. Another thing we have to worry about is the workers are trying to send votes to us, and maybe they don't send their, you know, maybe the vote doesn't get crossed the first time, so the worker is going to try to send it again, assuming he didn't get a response quickly. So if a worker sends a vote while we're aborted, we're just going to say, that's nice, we aborted. Here you go. And if a worker resends a vote in the committed step, we're going to say, okay, I already got that, we're committing. We're going to resend that response. So if a worker doesn't get the abort or commit message, it just sends its vote again, and we send back the result as best we know it. Okay, so questions? Yeah. So in this example, this diagram, it doesn't. We could easily fix that by adding a new type of message, which is wait for a response. But in either case, the worker actually, because the coordinator might fail, or the fail to send, it needs to do something where it asks again what's going on. So this deals with the general idea. Let's enumerate what happens when things fail, because that's the most tricky part of protocols like this, is what if a machine fails? And we'll start with the most annoying machine to fail, which is the coordinator. What if the coordinator is counting votes and it goes down? What should it do? So what it fails depends on what state it was in. And the way that we're going to structure the coordinator and the workers is we're going to track what state we're in our log. And based on what the log says our state in is, we're going to redo the operations for that state. So if our log says we were in init, we resend the prepare messages. And after we know we've done that, we mark ourselves as in wait. If a log says we're in wait or aborted, we can send the abort message to everyone. Because we know we haven't told anyone to commit, we're just going to make sure the transaction always aborts. Even if everyone else voted to commit, we're effectively voting to abort by doing that. and that's okay. And if we logged that we're in the committed state, which we'll do before we send those commit messages, we'll know to resend that information. And the coordinator can just resend things after timeouts, or the worker can resend things to the coordinator to try to get a reply. And that's how we deal with, like, a message is lost. We just have timeouts to retry things. And it's okay because we're tracking what state we're in. Okay, any questions on this? So the worker, here's a simplified state machine. So we're in initialize, we receive our prepare message, and we either agree to commit or abort. If we agree to abort, we say we're aborted, we write that down in our log, and we just never make the transaction happen. If anyone asks us what we're going to do, we're saying it's aborted. We can just vote to abort because it's aborted. We know it's not going to happen. And if we agree to commit, we just send that. And we remember we've done that. So if we crash here, we look, go back up, we say, oh, we agreed to commit, promise to do that. And we figure out whether the coordinator says everyone agreed to commit or not. Okay. And we have a similar idea that we have this log with our last state. And depending on that, we resend messages or redo operations for if it's committed to that. And we have to do resending after timeouts. If we don't get a message after a while, we'll just ask again for one or resend the message that would have triggered that message again. Okay, so questions on these models? Okay, so the state machines I've shown you are rather incomplete. So if you wanted to like do this to check if things are correct, we want to know what happens for every single message. And if you do that with enough precision, we could build something where we like check, you know, every possible time what's going to happen and like verify that we're not missing some case where we're going to like have some machine think the transaction committed and some not. And this is a notoriously tricky thing with protocols like this, that people miss those cases. But what we have, sort of our normal operation, is like if we have two workers, our coordinator tells each worker to prepare, they both commit, and before we send the prepare, we log, yep, we're waiting, we've agreed to commit, and we log, oh, we've got two commits, everyone's committed. So we have those logs in case we fail at any point after we write those log messages. And if we have something else happen, like we agree to abort, and then we just send abort messages based on that. And again, we log what state we're in. So here, the coordinator figures out, oh, we're aborted because I received one agree to abort vote. And if the coordinator crashes any point after that, it's going to remember that, even if this machine doesn't vote again. And this machine remembered it agreed to commit, but when it receives the abort, it's going to act on that and work appropriately. Okay, so questions about this model? Okay, and another thing that might happen is, what if we, you know, we start preparing a transaction and we have a crash? Well, we can just, when we come back, if we don't have a record of agreeing to commit, we know we didn't send an agree to commit message, so we can just say, I'm aborting it. And that's safe, because we know if we agreed to commit it, there'd be something in our log saying that, and so that's okay. So we can just say, you were trying this prepare? Well, I didn't get it, so I must have it must be aborted, because I know I would have a log if I had it. Alternately, maybe we record that we agreed to commit before we send it. Then when we come back, we read our log and we find out, okay, I agreed to commit this. I don't know why you didn't get the message. I don't care. I'm just telling you again I agreed to commit it. So any questions about these scenarios? Okay. So that's two-phase commit. So two-phase commit deals with this nice problem of we just want all the machines to agree to do the same thing. And this is nice when the data is split across the machines and everyone has to cooperate anyways. But we have this other model, which is very handy in distributed systems, where every node has a copy of the data. And our goal isn't to distribute the data across multiple machines, like for performance, or like to give each machine less workload, but is to work despite some of the nodes not working. So this is a different model, and it's going to have a similar type of solution, but basically the thing we're going to change is we don't want a unanimous vote, we want a majority vote. We want enough nodes to be working, lets everything happen. And the way we're going to do this is what's known as a quorum. So we're going to do a read or write with a quorum of nodes. And for example, here I have five machines. I'm going to say three machines is a quorum. So any three machines, if any three machines agree to do something, we're going to say that's good enough. So if machines B and E are down, I'm going to say, it's OK, I've did it on A, C, and D, and that's fine. And the reason why it's fine is because I know, because I've chosen to have three machines of my five, that if I contact any three machines, that's going to overlap with any other set of three machines I contact. So there's always going to be someone to say, hey, that thing you're writing was written later. You don't have the most up-to-date version. So I'm going to see every operation. I'm always going to have someone with the most up-to-date operation. So we're not going to have missing updates. So when the quorum votes to agree to do something, we're going to know that someone in that majority must know about every operation. Not necessarily everyone, but because I did every operation with a majority, someone in that set knew about it. So I'm not going to forget about something that previously happened. And that means that, importantly, I have this consistency property that no quorum is going to agree on something that conflicts with a past update. Because someone in the quorum will know about it and tell me, no, you can't do that. Okay, so questions about this basic idea? Of majority votes, dates. So an extension of this you might sometimes see is that here I'm having my quorums overlap, and that's enough. And that means that I'm sure that there's missing updates. Something that some systems do is we vary the quorum size based on the operation type. So for example, we might say to do an update, four people need to agree, four servers, but to do a read, only two. And that's fine, because we're guaranteed that every update set of machines overlaps with the read set of machines. There's one machine that has that update. And this is nice, because now I can do reads faster. I only need to contact two machines, so reads are less expensive. In exchange, writes are more expensive, but if we have less writes, that's fine. So that's quorum consistency. Now, the details of this are extremely tricky. And if you want the full details, there are two widely used schemes which achieve this type of consistency. One's called Raft, one's called Paxos. And they deal with all these nasty details. Like, what if, you know, our equivalent of the coordinator fails in this scheme? How do we do recovery? What if a machine comes back and doesn't have all the latest updates? What information do we actually log? Is it votes? What do the votes look like? So all that, those details are part of these schemes. So I'll give a brief sketch, high level, omitting lots of and very important details for correctness, of what Raft does. So Raft is a quorum consensus algorithm. And the way it works is it has like sort of two phases. So one phase is the machines elect what's called a leader. And basically this is acting like the coordinator for all the machines. So the leader is responsible for collecting votes from everyone and deciding what things actually get committed by storing that information on the other machines. So basically, we agree on this leader, and we have to have some mechanism. If a leader fails, all the nodes agree on a different leader, and we make sure that no one, that always a majority agree on a leader, that you don't act in the role of a leader, you don't start saying, I can do things as a coordinator, unless you know a majority of nodes say that that's okay for you to do. And we deal with, what if you become a leader and you aren't one anymore, with numbers that increment. So you have to be the latest leader, according to everyone, for them to accept your operations. And basically, the high-level view is the leader logs operations to other machines. And the idea is a transaction is committed in the system if we write it committed to a quorum of machines. And if we don't manage to do that, it's not committed. Okay. And as I said, I'm omitting lots of very important details about what if the leader fails, what if we write to some of the logs, but not all the ones, not a quorum. And those are all handled in the details of the protocol, which we'll not go into because it's very tricky and complicated. But this is the high-level view. So questions about the high-level idea? Okay. So this is what we use to make it so we have a cluster of machines, and some of them can fail, and the system still works. Sort of a nice mechanism for that. Now, what I've shown you so far only deals with fail stop. So we talked about the other type of failures was Byzantine failures, where nodes do the worst possible thing. And this makes things a lot more complicated. So for example, a type of failure we might imagine is something breaks on a machine and a node changes its mind about whether it agreed to commit to not. One example of something which might break is maybe our log is broken. Maybe our log hard drive is broken and we read the wrong thing from it. If we want to handle that sort of thing, there are ways of doing that, but we need to do things like confirm that everyone has consistent votes. And there's an important theoretical result that because of those ways you can have inconsistent votes and information, you need a lot of extra nodes. To handle one node failing, you need 4 nodes. To handle 2 nodes failing, you need 7. Just because otherwise you might get confused, is this machine down, or is this machine telling me the wrong information, and not get the whole thing. There's a protocol which is very well known, which is implementable, called practical Byzantine fault tolerance, which solves this problem. Okay, so any questions about quorum? Yeah?
Just to clarify, in practice, you have to handle both Byzantine and the fail stop.
So the question is, what do we do in practice? So in practice, most people use something like Raft, one of these quorum-based mechanisms, and assume that failures look sufficiently fail stop-like that this is okay. And they do other things for like data integrity, like checksums and things like that. It's very rare to see real systems use these Byzantine fault tolerant things, mainly because, so there's 2 reasons. So one reason is this cost is really high. You need a lot of extra machines. So like you might say running 3 or 5 nodes, that's fine. And if I'm running 5, I can handle 2 of them failing. That seems pretty good. Here, I need 7 to handle 2 failing, so on. The other issue is that this assumes that only that number of nodes fail, but for some types of failures, that actually isn't realistic. Because one common type of failure is a software bug. And if all the machines are running the same software, well, why would only a third of them fail? And so, like, if you really want to be paranoid about this, you either need to somehow you know, have very good testing for your software, or you want to have some reason to believe that if one machine's software has a bug, the other one won't. Like, they're independently written. And that's usually not realistic. Okay, other questions? Okay, so that's all I have for today. So next time we'll cover security. Well, access control, one small aspect of operating system security.